It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have U.S. Senator Ron Johnson on the line to talk about the federal response to the pandemic. The $3 trillion HEROES Act passed the House last Friday, but Senate Republicans are pushing back on a fresh round of coronavirus relief, balking at the overall cost of it. So what do you want to tell Senator Johnson about how Congress should handle pandemic-related aid? What do you want to know from the senator from Wisconsin? We're at 800-642-1234. Ron Johnson is a Republican in the Senate. He chairs the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee. Senator Johnson, welcome back to the Ideas Network. Senator Johnson, can you hear us?
Good morning, Kate. Hope you're staying healthy.
You too. I'm glad you can hear us. So last week, the House passed the $3 trillion relief package, sending it to the Senate. It includes another round of direct cash payments, an extension of unemployment benefits, hazard pay. How do you feel about it? Republicans are opposing it.
Well, we've already passed about $2.9 trillion of relief. It's a massive relief package. It was passed very fast, but just put it into perspective, many economists are saying we've shut down about 30% of our economy. That's about $600 billion a month. So just do the simple math, $2.9 trillion is almost 5 months of total replacement costs for 30% of our economy. So we've authorized more than enough money. It's hard to get exact up-to-date figures, but my staff's been tracking this pretty close. We've probably spent probably no more than $900 billion of that $2.9 trillion. So we still haven't spent $2 trillion. I, for the life of me, can't understand why you'd want to authorize another $3 trillion. So what we should be doing is taking a look at what we passed so rapidly. And again, I supported that. We had to flood financial relief to workers and to businesses and make sure that we provide liquidity to markets so they wouldn't collapse.
So you're saying a wait-and-see approach would be best right now?
I wouldn't say wait and see. What I would say is analyze what we've already done. Find out, you know, what businesses, what individuals that desperately need help aren't getting it right now. Why aren't they getting it? We all knew when we passed something that massive that fast would be far from perfect. It was far from perfect. And so there are many things I think we can fix about the program to make sure that, for example, PPP just blanketed the economy. You know, many businesses that didn't need PPP got it. I'm not blaming them. The standards were so low. They have no idea what additional shutdown orders may come about, so they thought they better step up the plate and get the loan. But there are many businesses that didn't get it, you know, particularly smaller Main Street businesses. And if you really take a look at how we've shut down the economy, and I have no animus toward big box stores, but they've been allowed to stay open. It's the Main Street businesses that compete with them that have been forced to shut down, and you've seen people's life savings wiped out. So we need to take a look at the exact economic impact of this coronavirus crisis and try and target relief in a more effective way than we have in the past.
Is there anything specifically that you're looking at in this new fresh round of coronavirus relief that you could see a compromise on?
Well, again, you take a look at the PPP program. It was somewhat restrictive. 8 weeks, 75% had to be payroll. A lot of businesses had already laid off workers. They had nothing for them to do. And so some businesses are requesting more flexibility in terms of the use of those PPP loans. I would, in general, be supportive of that. But if we're going to plus up and put more money in the PPP program, I certainly want to make sure that we direct it to those businesses that truly need it and don't continue to flood money to businesses that are, quite honestly, doing quite fine. You know, a lot of our economy is still up and operating. Some of our economy is actually going gangbusters because of the crisis. So let's make sure we don't provide funding to those businesses that truly don't need it and make sure we get it to the workers and the businesses that do.
Let's look at the World Health Organization for a moment and the funding there. Last month, President Trump froze U.S. funding for the WHO. What are you seeing in terms of that funding, permanently funding, ending funding for the WHO? Where do you stand?
Well, I think we need a World Health Organization in some shape or form, but it has to be free of corruption, and it has to play fair. And it wasn't free from corruption. It really pretty well did the Chinese government's bidding in this process, and that needs to be thoroughly investigated. From my standpoint, if U.S. funds are going to continue to flow to the World Health Organization, probably needs to have pretty much a complete management change at the top.
Let's take a call now. Carol is with us from Appleton. Hi, Carol.
Hi, good morning. I would like to ask the question referring back to the money that was dispensed for the plan for the American people and businesses. Who's watching the hen house on that? You had said, Senator Johnson, that you wanted to make sure that it went to the right people and such, but with President Trump firing the inspector generals, who's watching the hen house? Who's holding people accountable for where that money has gone and how it's being spent?
Well, first of all, thanks for the question. The inspector general that was fired was the inspector general for the State Department, so that individual would have no authority in this area anyway. Generally, it's going to be Office of Management and Budget looking at that pretty carefully, and then over time, Congress will have to take a look at that. But again, this money is flowing quickly. This will be the Treasury Department keeping tabs on it. It takes a while to account for all that. Unfortunately, government accounting systems are quite antiquated. Again, it's such a massive program. It was actually quite amazing how quickly the SBA was able to set up that program, how quickly that flowed through banks into the economy. That was the whole goal, is to get relief out to people quickly. And we knew it was not going to be 100% efficient. We knew it was not going to be 100% effective. The goal was, again, to make sure that markets didn't seize and that businesses hopefully could survive, hold on to employees for a short shutdown period. Unfortunately, the shutdown period seems to be elongated, and we need to take a look at the changed circumstances.
Carol, thanks. Let's go to Lyle now in Cornucopia. Hi, Lyle.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Senator, as a fellow conservative, I'm a little embarrassed that the president is firing four of those inspector generals. But my question for you is, how do you, as a conservative, rationalize bailing out $50 billion worth of private airline corporations and then standing with your senatorial leader, Mr. McConnell, and saying that we might just let states and local municipalities go bankrupt? This is kind of not conservative. It seems pretty radical for Republicans.
Senator Johnson?
Well, Lyle, first of all, all inspector generals work for the president. They need to remain independent within their agencies, but they need to report to the president and they serve at his pleasure. In the firm previous administration, or in my oversight work, We literally had two inspector generals resign because of the corruption we found out in their offices. So not all inspector generals are created equal. Some of them deserve to be fired. In terms of bailing out the airline industry, it is a vital industry for our economy. And it is through no fault of their own that the coronavirus completely tanked their sales and grounded their aircraft. So if you want to be able to travel when this crisis has passed, I think most Americans would agree that we probably ought to do something to prop up something that's so incredibly vital to the operation of our economy. But that's true of so many other businesses, which is why we passed this $2.9 trillion relief package.
Senator Johnson, why did your committee, Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs, subpoena documents on Blue Star Strategies yesterday? Your colleague Kamala Harris from California said this: there are literally life and death matters on the line, and you're issuing a subpoena.
Well, this just is a continuation of our ongoing oversight efforts, but Senator Harris is fully aware of the fact that the majority of committee staff and the majority of committee work is focused on the coronavirus. We've already held at least three hearings on this coronavirus. So we are participating in multiple conference calls per week with members of the administration, FEMA. This administration has been incredibly transparent in consulting with Congress in terms of its efforts on COVID.
Senator Johnson, thank you for joining us.
Have a good day. Stay healthy.
You too. U.S. Senator Ron Johnson. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, it is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're talking about the National Guard's deployment mission to carry out COVID-19 testing and contact tracing under federal orders known as Title 32. Are you deployed in this capacity? Have you received word that your deployment will end on June 24th? How does that affect your pay and benefits? We're at 800-642-1234. Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico covering Capitol Hill. Alice, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you.
Well, take us to the situation here with the National Guard. You're calling it a hard stop. What is going on here about this mission and their service under Title 32?
So the hard stop language comes from a recording of a call we obtained between top Trump administration officials discussing the June 24 end date of the federal deployment of the National Guard. As you know, they're serving all over the country. They're really the backbone of the coronavirus relief effort. They're running testing sites. They're doing contact tracing. They're delivering food to food banks. In your state, they even served as poll workers. And so it would be a real hardship for states to lose those men and women performing those services. But it also is a very important date for the service members themselves because they would fall just one day short of qualifying for certain federal benefits, including early retirement credits and education tuition assistance.
So June 24th has a significance because that is a date when it would be within the guidelines for not being able to deliver on those types of benefits?
Yes. So you need to serve for 90 days under this federal status during like a federal declared emergency. And June 24 would be day 89 for thousands of members. So it is still possible they could extend that. But the official on the call we obtained described it as a hard stop. They have not announced an extension yet. No other officials on the call raised the possibility of an extension. So we will have to see what happens.
You've been talking with lawmakers about this. What have they been saying?
Yes, a lot of lawmakers are outraged about this. There have already been bills introduced in response to our reporting. Some would ensure that the service members get those benefits even if they fall short of 90 days. Some would extend the federal deployment both so that they qualify and so that the states can maintain those services. And there are also lots of members of Congress, dozens, more than 78, in fact, writing to the Trump administration saying not only demanding that the federal deployment be extended, but also demanding an explanation for why the June 24 date was chosen in the first place. Because in addition to it falling right on day 89, just shy of this qualifying threshold, it's a random Wednesday in the middle of a week, in the middle of a month. These deployments usually are extended month to month or for several months. And so they're saying, you know, you really need to explain why you did this.
We're talking with Alice Miranda Olstein, a healthcare reporter for Politico covering Capitol Hill, looking at the Guard's mission under Title 32 and what would happen if more than 40,000 Guard members would have to abruptly stop this mission of COVID testing in states. You can join in with your questions, 800-642-1234. So, Alice, before these Guard members return to their civilian life, they would perhaps have to be under a self-quarantine for 2 weeks because they have been doing this work, being in contact with specimens and other work that is putting them in perhaps harm's way of getting the coronavirus. What does that mean for the actual end date then of the deployment?
That's absolutely right. So June 24 is the official end of the deployment as of right now. But this means that for 2 weeks prior to that, they wouldn't be able to be out in the community doing that work. They would have to be in self-quarantine to make sure they don't bring the virus back to their own communities when they return to civilian life. And so states could lose their services in early June if this is not extended. And this is important because the National Guard confirmed to me that more than 1,000 members across the country have contracted coronavirus, including more than 600 active cases.
And so how is the National Guard responding here? They're giving you some numbers. What else are they saying?
So they are emphasizing that an extension could still be announced in the coming weeks. And so we will just have to stay on top of this story and see what happens and see if the pressure from lawmakers and governors who are really concerned about this produces an impact.
does the federal, does the National Guard that you, the people you've talked with, have any indication how long these federal orders will be under Title 32 and how long this mission will be of COVID-19 testing in states and other activities related to the coronavirus?
So lawmakers for the last few months and governors and state officials, they've been asking for much longer federal deployments under Title 32. For example, the entire congressional delegation for Colorado wrote to President Trump asking for it to be extended until the end of the year, so anticipating that need will continue. And officials in Washington State I spoke to say, look, we won't suddenly not need these services on June 25th. Of course, we're going to still, as states reopen, need them even more to perform testing and contact tracing. They're going into nursing homes where there have been outbreaks and doing deep cleanings and decontaminations, delivering food to food banks. I mean, with the economic crisis going on, that need is going to continue for a long time. And so that's why a lot of lawmakers on Capitol Hill, in response to our reporting, wrote to the Trump administration and said, look, we really need you to extend this for the duration of the federal emergency declaration, because states are going to keep having to depend on these services.
And only partial numbers of the National Guard may be called up in states. Would it be a situation that they would rotate out Guard members after 89 days?
So states could keep some Guard members on what's known as state active duty, but states would have to pay for that themselves. And states have been hit very, very hard by the current situation and just don't have any money. And every state is debating deep, deep budget cuts to very important parts of the government and would not be able to shoulder the large cost of keeping all of the Guard members on. And so you could see a rotation, like you said, or you could just see a smaller force maintained.
How is the price tag here? How much does having these National Guard members out in the communities, how much does this mission cost?
So the National Conference of State Legislatures estimates the cost to be $9 million per 1,000 troops per month. So that is a lot for states to take on right now, given that tax revenues have cratered and what states are having to spend to address this crisis is so high.
So if states have all of this COVID-19 testing structure in place with public health departments working very closely with the National Guard, if this does happen where you have a hard stop, does that mean testing programs, community testing programs, collapse in the U.S.?
I mean, it's a real concern, and that's why some of the letters from lawmakers and state officials to the president have stressed this and have warned that as states reopen, these services are needed more than ever. And they say that the loss of Guard members out there on the front lines could even contribute to a second wave of infection.
Do we know how states are generally putting these Guard members to work under these federal orders? Is it pretty typical from state to state? Like here in Wisconsin, it has a lot to do right now with free community testing on those missions and contact tracing.
Yes. So definitely on those two points, but it can also vary state to state. And we could see those Guard members stretched even thinner given different weather events happening in different states where they will both have to respond at the same time to the pandemic and performing the services we've discussed, as well as addressing a fire or a flood or a hurricane. And so they're just going to be needed more than ever in the coming months.
So when will we hear next steps? What are you watching for in terms of an announcement as to what will happen here?
So it could really come at any time. And the response we've gotten from the Trump administration has been like, look, this is more than a month away. Don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. And we reported last night that there has been a plan drafted to extend the deployment through the end of July. It's not yet known whether or not the president will sign that order. So we are going to stay on top of this. We are going to be asking the White House and the Defense Department what's going to happen and make sure to keep readers informed.
Alice, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Alice Miranda Olstein is a healthcare reporter for Politico. Coming up, Major League Baseball presented a proposal to players last week detailing health and safety measures to get back on the field. What do you think about plans for restarting MLB by the 4th of July? We're at 800-642-1234. We'll explore what the future holds for pro baseball and basketball, by the way, with a pair of sports reporters right after this news update. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A quick signpost here. WPR has added additional newscasts each weekday. We have a growing collection of pandemic-related articles, data, analysis. It's all at WPR.org/COVID for you to check out. Right now, we're talking about what it takes to jumpstart the Major League Baseball season amid the pandemic. The league presented a 67-page health and safety operations manual to the Players Association last week, giving detailed procedures of what an abbreviated season would look like. Rigorous testing, dugout seating charts, no spitting, by the way, post-game showers in the locker room, bad idea. How do you feel about Major League Baseball's plans for restarting by July 4th? What are your concerns? What do you do if you were the commissioner? It's 800-642-1234 to join in. Lori Nickel is a sports columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Lori, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. How are you doing?
Doing well. We also have Bradford Doolittle, an ESPN writer who covers baseball. Brad, thanks for being here.
Good to be with you, Kate.
Well, Brad, let's start with you. South Korea started its baseball league in earlier this month, possibly showing the way for other pro sports around the world. What do you see South Korea doing that may translate here?
Well, South Korea has had a different program from the beginning with how they've handled the pandemic. And they've been very aggressive in terms of using technology to track people, to do contact tracing. And once they got their infection rates down, they had that system in place. And, you know, there are a number of American players and coaches that work in that league. And I know some of them think that the program that they have in South Korea isn't necessarily comparable to what we could put in place in this country, both because of the scale, but also just differences in attitude. And, you know, I think that's a broader conversation than sports, but I think they have shown that it is possible for two baseball teams to gather in a mostly empty stadium and play games without, an outbreak from just those players being around each other.
Are the stadiums completely empty then?
Well, there's the essential personnel of the people needed to stage the game and the umpires, but they aren't letting in fans at this point. They're playing in empty stadiums and sort of, just trying to drum up atmosphere with music and whatnot. And I think that's the scenario, definitely a scenario we'd be looking at here if we get going again.
Lori, have you been watching what South Korea is doing, what baseball looks like there?
No, I haven't been too much. I've just been reading about it, but I like that. I think they mentioned that if somebody did test positive, I think they said that they would shut down for 2 or 3 weeks. That sounded like a good idea. It just seemed like a pretty progressive approach.
So what have you been doing then? Are you looking to leagues around the world? Where do you get insights on what it will take, Lori, to jumpstart pro sporting events again here in America?
Well, it looks like it's really going to take that first major league professional sport to kind of make that first step. You know, the NBA was the first team to shut down, you know, and then a lot of the other leagues followed. And it just looks like whether, you know, the players agree to all the testing and all the financial arrangements that have to be made. Like in baseball, that's a big contention right now. You know, everybody's losing money. It looks like players like might lose up to half their income. It just seems like who's going to lead this? And I kind of wonder if the NBA will do it. I kind of expect them to. I've been watching Major League Baseball as well, and that safety report that they put out was pretty good. But then you see all the arguments between the union, the players, and the owners. So I kind of am looking to the NBA to see what they're going to do next.
Brad, you know, some league is going to have to be the guinea pig here. Who will it be?
Well, I don't know that the leagues are necessarily looking at it as a competition with one another to get this going. The NBA has certain advantages in terms of they were far enough into their season so that if they decide that the way to do it is to just not bring back every team, but just bring back, you know, a number of playoff teams. And I don't know to what extent they would change their playoff format rather than resuming the regular season. Then they have that option. And so they'd be looking at fewer teams. And of course, NBA rosters are significantly smaller than those of baseball rosters. We're talking about probably 50 players per team in Major League Baseball versus around 15 for the NBA. So the logistics are very different, but also the nature of the sports are different. There's a lot more contact in basketball. So that's another concern. So I think both leagues are taking it sort of a day by day, week by week basis. And they're both in negotiations with their players association. So it's hard to say, but I kind of think if one league gets going, we'll see the other one get going right around the same time.
We're talking about professional sports, baseball's plans for restarting. We have Brad Doolittle from ESPN, Lori Nickel here from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. And your thoughts as well. What questions do you have about how Major League Baseball would come together for play? What do you want to know? How do you feel about plans for restarting by July 4th? What are your concerns? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. So, Brad, what does this plan look like to start around the 4th of July, or what is coming together there for that particular date?
Well, assuming that the players and owners are able to come to an economic accord and the health program that baseball has proposed can be tweaked and evolved to the point that the players feel safe in coming back, then they're talking about having probably around a 3-week spring training during June. And those spring trainings would probably be held in the home ballparks of every team, assuming that all of there's 27 cities involved in Major League Baseball. So that's a lot of different situations. But insofar as every team can play in their home park, they would just have spring training there and then get going on July 4th with an opening day. But of course, everything with this health situation evolves constantly. So, you know, by the time we hear about plans, they've probably already changed. So it's a day by day drama.
Sure. I'm sure there are so many different scenarios going on there. Lori, what are your concerns about a 4th of July start?
Well, for baseball, it seems great. For basketball, it seems really bizarre to even be talking about that, but they're also looking at, the NBA is looking at a return around that time as well. You know, I hope that, you know, once the financial stuff is agreed to with baseball, if they can come to that, that the players can get on board with all the social distancing rules. And I know they're weird. I know it's, you know, no sunflower seeds and no high fives and no leaving the hotel and all that, but we're all making adjustments and adaptations to our own personal lives. So even if they make the rules super strict, which it kind of sounds like they're almost unreasonable, at least there's the effort, or it's in the consciousness of people to make some changes and to maybe not have too much contact so that it helps bring things back to life. I would like to see sports come back. I would like to see the businesses get going and the cities that rely on you know, the small businesses around these teams and the people whose jobs rely on this to come back as well. So, some of the complaints that I see from players about, well, this isn't baseball and all that, I hope that changes and people adjust.
Brad, help us give us some context here about the money situation. If the league were to cancel the season completely, altogether, what would that mean to the owners and the players, the fans, the broadcasters?
Well, I can't speak to the broadcasters, but you know, as an industry, Major League Baseball brought in around $10.7 billion of revenue last year. And the vast majority of that would just not exist if they don't play any games, because their media contracts or advertising contracts are all contingent upon actually having games to sell. And then, of course, even if they do play, that's most likely going to be without much revenue at the gate or merchandise sales at the stadium or concessions and that kind of thing. The players were given initially when baseball first shut down I believe it was $170 million as sort of an advance on their salaries. And then in March, they came to an agreement in which the players would be paid a prorated amount of their agreed to salary of how many games actually get to be played. That's sort of the bone of contention right now. The owners say that agreement was dependent upon having games with fans. The players say that was the agreement no matter what. So that's kind of the central point of the negotiation that's happening right now.
Do we know whether public health officials have a seat at the table in these negotiations? How are they going down?
Right now, baseball says that they have worked, and they have worked with public health experts to form these plans and have stayed in contact with the Players Association. At this point, according to an expansive report out at ESPN right now, they have not gone to every individual municipality to discuss the specific guidelines in place everywhere. But they say that is the next step, and that should happen in the next couple of days. You know, I'm in Chicago right now. They would not allow a team of 30 players per team, plus umpires, plus broadcasters, plus probably a handful of sports writers. They would not allow them to gather in one place. You would not be able to stage baseball games. So they're going to have to work with each individual city to find out what needs to happen between now and then to allow teams to play in their home ballparks.
Because each municipality has a different approach right now to social distancing and regulations over that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it also depends on how the trend lines with the epidemic progress from here and until then. You know, a lot of people are looking at Georgia because it was one of the states that were most aggressive at reopening, and the infection rates in the county where the Braves play, and they do not play in downtown Atlanta, seem to be edging up. And so if that gets out of control, the Players Association is not going to be comfortable with players going to play in Cobb County, Georgia. So
we have sports reporters Brad Doolittle from ESPN, Lori Nickel from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, columnist there, looking into their crystal balls to predict what happens with pro sports amid the pandemic. Your thoughts as well, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. We're talking about what it takes to bring back professional sports in the middle of a global pandemic. So Major League Baseball is in the thick of planning and negotiations to piece together a 2020 season. But in order to put on games in empty stadiums, you need the dozens of MLB teams. You need the league offices. You need the broadcasters. Many people still to orchestrate something like that. So if you were a pro sports athlete, how would you want to be tested for the coronavirus? What would you want to happen if a player or coach tests positive? How are you supporting your favorite team in this health crisis? Still time to talk, 800-642-1234. We have Lori Nickel from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and Brad Doolittle from ESPN. They stay with us. Let's take a call on this now. Wayne is joining us from Port Washington. Hi, Wayne.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I guess my question is more related to the NBA, but if they would, just for example, continue the playoffs, let's say, starting in July, then that's a good 2 to 3 month season in itself. So now let's say they finish sometime in September and a normal season just gets going in October with preseason. And my question is kind of, if they would go ahead and do that, does that not really compromise next year's season? Would they not have to shorten that?
Wayne, thanks. Lori, can you field that timetable?
Sure, Wayne. They would delay the start of the 2021-2022 season. They would, I don't know how much they would delay it by, but they had already talked about finishing this season this summer and then having a delay. So instead of, the Bucks training camp starting in mid-October and play that first week in November, you would see probably a 1 to 2, even maybe 2.5 month delay. But I would hope that the Bucks and the NBA would also consider a truncated playoff season where they might play fewer games, especially in the first couple of rounds, to shorten the playoff season, because it is normally 2 months and a week or so, about 7 or 8 weeks.
Wayne, how do you feel if the NBA would come back online?
Well, I would be excited in one way. It would be different, of course. I'm really wondering, for those teams like the Bucks that will participate in the playoffs, they'll be going pretty much, well, they'll start up and go full bore right up until hopefully the end of the playoffs. But, you know, NBA players are used to having a nice long off season to recuperate. And would that not give an advantage to those teams who, well, they didn't make the playoffs this year, but they'll be much more rested than, say, a Bucks team that has played? Because I think in the NBA that a lot of times this sort of long-term fatigue can lead to injuries. And when you have star players who more or less carry the league, that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, Brad, the more you win, the more your team gets fatigued. And if that timetable is close and a losing team hasn't been on the court for a while, that could be an advantage.
It could be. These are also young, world-class athletes. And, you know, I think at the very least, they would have 3, 4, 5 weeks between the end of the season and the start of the next to recover. And no, it's not normal, but there's nothing about this situation that's normal. And teams would manage those players going forward with that in mind. You know, maybe they would limit the exposure of them minutes wise at the outset of a season. So no, it's not ideal, but I mean, there's just no outcome from any of this that's going to be ideal, both for the seasons that we're waiting on right now, but all the effects of all this will clearly lag into next year as well.
Wayne, thanks for the call. Brad, I want to talk a little bit about that health and safety proposal that was put forth last week. It has lots of specifics on the players. It's very detailed. What did you think of it?
Well, I mean, the specific details, I think it sends a clear message that players will be held accountable for their behavior. And I think they know that, but just that it won't be business as usual. And, you know, I don't think we'd see a situation where a player is thrown out of a game for spitting. But it's more to establish what the standards are so players will understand, and also signal to everybody watching that they are trying to do this in a manner as safe as possible. My concerns with the entire program were more in terms of how they're going to handle a positive test. And right now, baseball's saying that they'll quarantine the infected player while testing the people that he came in contact with, but not quarantining the people that he came in contact with, the other players. And that's a concern. We need to make sure that the tests are done rapidly and are as accurate as possible, because those players will then be circulating in the general public. And the other part of it is we also need to know and be assured that the resources that are going to be needed to stage these games, whether it's baseball, the NBA, or whatever, are not impacting the general public health effort in this country, because, you know, everybody's competing for the same resources. So this can't take away from the health of the public at large.
Lori, what do you think there? If a player tests positive, say, during the playoffs, do they get benched for 2 weeks and miss that series and they're your star player?
Yeah, that's how, I mean, what the NBA hasn't really laid out the same plan that Major League Baseball has so far, but that's, you know, when Rudy Gobert tested positive for the NBA in March, they shut down the whole league. So I'm assuming that since they took such a proactive approach then, that, you know, that they would be, if somebody tested positive, they would have to follow the same guidelines that the CDC has recommended. So I wouldn't expect anything different from the NBA.
We're talking about pro sports plans for restarting. We have Lori Nickel from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, Brad Doolittle from ESPN. Still time for your thoughts on where your favorite team is headed, and would you want them to come back under these conditions? 800-642-1234. So, Brad, how would you feel covering a sport if you couldn't be there in the stadium?
Well, that would be not ideal. I think, within the Baseball Writers Association, we're having those discussions as far as like what's acceptable and what's not acceptable. We understand that access to the clubhouse is almost certainly a non-starter. And the press box situations in every stadium are different. You know, the press box at Wrigley Field and Dodger Stadium is much smaller than the press box at Miller Park. You're going to have a limit to how many people that can go in there. And I think there's also the option to maybe allow a certain amount of writers into the ballpark and just work from a seat in the stands so that you're safely distance away from everybody. So we'll work that out. You know, the players and the owners are trying to figure out how to divide billions of revenue right now. And I think how they handle the sports writers aspect of it is far down the list. But I personally, as long as distancing measures are in place and I am allowed to wear a mask and the other sports writers are expected to wear a mask, would feel comfortable covering a game. But I need to see how those plans are put in place.
Lori, last time we talked with you, you were just really bummed out about the whole sports world and even, you know, watching old games and things like that. Have you come around at all? Are you okay?
Yes. No, not at all. No. Yes. We have created our, you know, everything is canceled, too, as far as races and triathlons and stuff that we sports writers participate in. So we're just kind of creating our own with three or four people. But no, I think this is tough on a lot of people. It's a good distraction, but I've learned a lot from this, and I do hope it comes back. I think there are ways that the sports world can kind of set an example of how to come back safely, and so I hope that it works out.
Brad, how are sports writers spending their days right now at ESPN?
You know, it's funny. People are saying, so what have you been doing with all your downtime? But the crazy thing is it hasn't really been downtime because, you know, this situation is so different than what we're used to. We spend months planning on how we're going to roll out our coverage during the season. And then all of a sudden, all of those plans were completely moot because there's no season to cover. Now, of course, we have to do everything we can to find out what's happening with possible plans to restart. But we also just have to come up with content, whether or not there are games being played. And so, it's been actually pretty busy, and it's been busy in a way that's weird because, you know, you're having to use your imagination a lot more. You can't just look and say, who's hot, who's not. So
it's a different type of busy. Yeah. Thank you both for joining us. We appreciate it.
Thank you very much, Kate.
Thank you. Thank you. Take care.
You too. Lori Nickel, sports columnist for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. Bradford Doolittle, an ESPN writer who covers baseball. Just ahead, we have Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin joining us to discuss the pandemic. I'm Kate Archer Kent. It is The Morning Show. You're listening to the Ideas Network.